The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample, and to a special show dedicated to the Longitude Prize 2014.
My watch lost 1 minute, 53 and a half seconds after 81 days at sea. As witnessed and signed in the papers you have before you, which you seem so keen to put away, I have fulfilled the terms most exactly as laid down in the Act of Queen Anne, and I demand that you consider the question of my reward.
The great Michael Gambon there, and a heroic portrayal of a giant in the history of British science, John Harrison, creator of Harrison's clock, which changed how we navigate the globe, and the device that won the first Longitude Prize. This week we discuss a new chapter in the Longitude Prize. After 300 years, a new challenge and a new prize are coming.
Not the winner, but the number two challenger was a guy who worked in a tattoo parlour, and he and two colleagues decided they could come up with this clever idea, and they did. So there are areas where it requires inventive skill rather than necessary deep knowledge of science.
We'll be hearing from two members of the new Longitude Committee, Astronomer Royal Lord Martin Rees and the UK's Chief Medical Officer Dame Sally Davies, on the scientific challenges that could win the £10 million prize, and how the public, yes that means you and me, how we can inform the nature of that challenge. This is a very special edition of Science Weekly from The Guardian. To discuss the new Longitude Prize with me today, I'm joined by the Guardian and Observer team, Nicola Davis, commissioning editor of the award-winning Observer Tech Monthly, and Adam Vaughan, the Guardian's online environment editor. Also, welcome back to Dr. Emily Grossman, broadcaster and expert in molecular biology. Welcome back, Emily. Welcome all.
Hello.
Hello. Hi.
But first, the Longitude Committee is a gathering of the grandees of the British science community, and none more so than Lord Martin Rees. When we met, I began by asking our Astronomer Royal to tell us a bit more about the history of the prize and its winner, John Harrison.
In 1714, the government realised that a big technical challenge was to measure longitude at sea, which involved keeping time very accurately, and they set up a challenge offering a reward of up to £20,000 for whoever could achieve a certain level of precision. And it wasn't clear what the technique was going to be. Most of the establishment thought it would be better astronomy, monitoring the position of the moon and the stars. But in fact, as is widely known, the prize was won by an outsider, John Harrison, a Yorkshire mechanic who'd started off making wooden clocks when he was young, and he built a chronometer which survived a transatlantic voyage and was only 5 seconds out at the end of that voyage. He won this prize, and that's an example of a challenge prize where a reward stimulates and encourages innovation. And of course, since that time there have been many other challenge prizes. The first transatlantic flight by Lindbergh was done as a challenge prize. There have been some prizes that haven't been won. For instance, more than 100 years ago, a French foundation offered 100,000 francs for finding extraterrestrial life. That still hasn't been won. And in fact, they said Mars didn't count. That was too easy. So some prizes haven't been won. But in recent years, there have been quite a number of challenge prizes. For instance, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Projects Research Agency in the US, has had a number in driverless cars and robotics, etc. And the XPRIZE Foundation had one for manned space flight, and there's now a lunar challenge. And it's a very nice challenge for the so-called Methuselah mouse, a mouse that can live for 5 years, which hasn't been won yet. So these are a way in which one can incentivize innovation, hopefully from people outside the establishment. And some of us thought that it was good to commemorate the 300th anniversary of the original Longitude Act, which set up the Longitude Prize, by having some UK national challenge prizes. And that has led to this present project.
And the aim of making this a prize, a £10 million prize, what do you think that does? Why is that better or how does that differ from just funding research in these areas as is going on already?
Well, it does differ, of course, but let's put it in perspective and realise that £10 million may seem a lot, but it's one part in a thousand of what is spent every year on R&D by the UK government. So obviously most of the funding for R&D does go by the conventional route of grants, but I think the idea of spending this very small fractional amount on this different type of incentive is worthwhile because it may draw in people outside the establishment, and I think it has a bonus of attracting public interest because one of the problems that we'll have to sort out in actually defining the challenge is to pick something which the public can follow. For instance, robotics competitions are a good spectator sport, and so they can stimulate public interest and thereby have an extra effect over and above, hopefully leading to some innovation. But this isn't going to change the world, but let's bear in mind it's a way in which we are spending one part in a thousand of 1 year's money which the government spends on R&D, and I think in that perspective it'll punch above its weight.
You chair the committee that came up with the six challenges from which people can vote on to become on the prize, if you like, the prize challenge. How do you arrive at these six big issues that science and technology need to address?
Well, with difficulty, obviously. And also another point is that we had to pick areas where we felt it would be conceivable to devise a suitable prize. To take two examples, I mean, carbon capture and sequestration is a big project, but £10 million is neither here nor there in that. Ditto for drug development. And so we've got to pick themes where we're pretty sure that we could find challenges of the right level which can draw in a lot of people with modest resources. But even then, it was quite hard.
So did anything come up that didn't make the grade? Can you remember any of the ideas that were shot down?
Well, there were quite a lot, and obviously we combined some of them. Because to take one example, food is very broad because that could involve improvement in agriculture, could involve GM, could involve making insects more palatable to eat to get proteins, all kinds of things. So we could have subdivided some of the challenges.
300 years ago, John Harrison won the prize for longitude, and his single innovation completely solved that problem. Is it a bit naive to think that that model can still apply, that you can still have maybe not an individual, but even a single team can come along and with one invention, one innovation, actually make a big impact on one of these challenges?
Indeed, that's very naive because, as I said, we're talking about a fraction of 1% of what's being spent every year on R&D. So it's not going to change the world. But all I would argue is that it might produce better value than the average £10 million is spent on R&D.
Take us through what the six challenges are.
Yes. Well, the first one is antibiotic resistance. And this is championed by Sally Davis, the government's chief medical officer. And, of course, that may be perceived to involve drug development. That's what we're doing. But the sort of thing which she has in mind is developing some kind of litmus test, as it were, whereby someone in Africa could very cheaply and reliably decide whether their disease is a viral or bacterial infection, to avoid the waste of antibiotics when they're not needed. Because, of course, the problem with antibiotics is that they're often being prescribed when they're not needed. And in the US, they're even given to cows, which makes it even worse. So we want to minimize the use. So that's just one example of how there could be a simple invention which could be widely used, which could aim to reduce the problem of antibiotic resistance.
And you've got water there, which is looking at desalination technology?
There's water and food. Food, I mentioned, could cover any of those areas. But we know that given that there will be 9 billion people in the world, or more demanding, we hope, and wanting a higher protein diet, etc., there is going to be a problem to feed them all, given the constraints of resources. And also for water, one wants a way of getting pure fresh water to places where don't yet have it. So these are both areas where we feel there could be a variety of challenges. And if they're chosen, we will have to decide on what a particular challenge would be that would be appropriate for the prize. And we obviously haven't yet done that. But one point I should make at this stage before we talk about the other three is that the hope would be that the five that don't win the public vote may be taken up by commercial or philanthropic sponsors. So the ideal would be to have a whole suite of prizes. There'll be the Longitude Prize, which is £10 million of public money from the government, And there could be others which would be privately sponsored. That's the hope anyway.
Okay.
So it's antibiotic resistance, and there's food and water. And the next two are really ways in which technology can actually help those people who are currently disadvantaged, those who have paralysis or some similar handicap, and those who suffer from dementia. In the case of paralysis, obviously we know that robotic exoskeletons are developing. There are clever ideas how the mind can directly control mobility, etc. And so in that area, there is scope for innovation. And that's the kind of area where some of the clever software could make a difference. And the dementia challenge obviously is a huge medical challenge, but one thing which would make a difference would be if there were simple ways of ensuring that people with that condition can live more independently and safely by being monitored, by prompts to remind them to do certain things, to check whether they've done what they should have done, etc. And again, this is a kind of area where lots of ingenuity could make people's lives better. It's not going to solve the problem, but it's a area where lots of people could join in. So that's two in the area of looking after people. And the sixth is low-carbon flight. And the issue here, obviously, is that we know that we need to move towards a low-carbon economy, low-carbon transport of all kinds. And the most challenging type of transport is obviously flights, and it's not clear how far we can get, but the idea is to try and stimulate innovation in solar and battery technology with the aim of being able to fly a plane a bit further than planes of that kind have flown hitherto.
As the chair of the committee, are you allowed to have a favourite, or are you above that?
Well, I do have some favourites, but I think it's probably better if I don't actually express them. I think there are some of the areas where it's going to be easier to devise a suitable prize than others. And I should mention that the prize has to be not too easy, obviously, but it's got to be something which can be solved within 5 years, and probably also with some intermediate steps where there's a target for what to do after 1 year, etc. So that's going to be the challenge. And what we will do when we know which is the winning theme is convene a group of experts on that theme, and it'll be their job over the summer to actually define the prize.
Lord Rees, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your thoughts on all of this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lord Rees mentioned there that the challenge of antibiotic resistance is championed by one of his fellow committee members, Dame Sally Davies, the UK's chief medical officer. I spoke to her down the line and asked her why this particular scientific challenge was worthy of the Longitude Prize.
We all rely on antibiotics. Modern medicine is predicated on having them. Yet, every time a bug multiplies, and that's on average every 20 minutes, there's a risk of mutation which can develop resistance to antibiotics. And then not only does that pass through to new generations, it can also infect other bacteria. So we are running out of antibiotics. There is a pretty empty pipeline of new antibiotics. That means we've got to look after antibiotics that we have really carefully, because the bugs are winning this arms race at the moment, and we are risking modern medicine. You know, cancer therapies, surgery, transplantation, kidney dialysis are all based on having effective antibiotics. And it touches every one of us. If you go with a child to the GP and you say, child's got a high temperature and a sore throat, my daughter is very sick, please give me an antibiotic. If that is a virus, it won't respond to an antibiotic. If it is a bacteria, it will respond as long as it's not got resistance. So how do you distinguish? So the prize we're looking for is a gizmo, a black box that you could put in GP surgeries, in pharmacies, in the desert, so that people can say, is this a bacteria or not? So that we preserve antibiotics, we don't overuse them and use them in silly ways. Now, why is this one prizable? First of all, you can get yourself around it. You can understand the problem. Secondly, it's quantifiable what the difference, would be that it's made. It could be used routinely in GP surgeries, pharmacies, day in, day out, and help save the antibiotics we've got and make them last longer. Thirdly, it looks as if the technologies are all out there, but they need to be brought together in an unusual, different way. And that's why a prize which attracts people who are not in the mainstream, but are real inventors or innovators more, is a very good idea. For instance, I was told only last week about a man who has been working with printed porphyrins, actually, that then take the respiration of bugs and go different colours depending on the bug, and you print them. Now, I don't know whether that's the right technology, but something very simple that you can print, put in a black box, that you swab the throat and then put it in and you get a colour change, say, like you would for a pregnancy test, and it's got to be cheap and easy, is doable in that case. And you can just get your hands around it. We need a black box that brings together different technologies that will distinguish whether this is a bacteria.
Do you see antimicrobial resistance as a problem now in various parts of the world or in various parts of medicine in the UK, in the Western world? Or is this something that is more looming on the horizon?
People are dying of antibiotic resistance in this country every day. 5,000 people die of E. coli resistance in the bloodstream each year in England. About 25,000 minimum die in the EU every year of antibiotic resistance. That's about the same number as road traffic accidents. And then there's about at least 23,000 in the States. So people are already dying of antibiotic resistance. And that's not because we've always used antibiotics badly. Some is that we have abused them, particularly as the public rather than the professionals. But some, like gonorrhea, where there's 2% resistance to the last cephalosporin in this country, people are only treated in specialist clinics according to guidelines. So they have been done properly. But these bugs are just very clever. They mutate very easily. They are very smart. And they will win the race. And we will lose modern medicine if we don't do something about it.
So there are signs of the situation worsening?
Oh, yes. And a recent surveillance report put out by the World Health Organization about a month ago shows the magnitude of this all over the globe. This is not Britain and the EU. It's not the North versus the South. This is occurring everywhere across the world.
What do you think is going to be tough about having the kind of diagnostic you want for this challenge? Are there any issues over whether if you pick up an organism in someone, knowing whether that is actually causing what is making them ill?
Generally, if someone is ill with, a fever, looking ill and has a high white count, and then you find a bacteria in their bloodstream, you know that's the cause. Ditto if they've got earache and they're really sick and you find that a bacteria, you know that that's what it is. Sore throats, if they've got pus on the back of their throat and you show it's a bacteria, which it generally is if there's pus, then you know that's what's caused it. So now the issue is getting hold of the clinical specimen and then doing the diagnosis. And if you don't have a full bacteriology laboratory bang next to you, and anyway, then growing the bugs takes time, it's difficult to give the first-line treatment as the best treatment. So a little black box is very important, or a big black box. I think there are issues because it needs to be heat-stable, because if it's got to be kept at a steady temperature, it won't work in the summer in some GP practices or in the desert, and we need this to work around the world. And clearly cost. I think we've got to have something that is cheap to do. If it's too expensive, GPs and the developing world will not make it part of their routine practice. So part of the challenge for this prize is not just making it happen. I think it's experts could make this happen quite quickly. It's making it happen in a way that's affordable to all of us.
Huge thanks to Dame Sally Davis there, and a passionate advocate for a category that I know Emily Grossman will be championing. Why is the device Sally Davis describes the challenge of our time?
Well, as Sally just talked about, antibiotics are so crucial to modern medicine. In the last 80 years since they were discovered, they've saved over 80 million lives, and they've added on average 20 years to each of our lives. And they've actually saved more lives and done more good than any other type of drug. And as she talked about, the fact that we are running out of ones to use, we haven't got any new antibiotics coming up, and the ones we are using, we're getting more and more resistant to, means it's just so crucial that we stop using the ones that we have and stop overusing them in situations where we don't need to. So this device that she talked about could save, well, at the moment, 5,000 lives a year, and potentially more and more and more as we're getting depleted with our supplies of the ones that we can use because of resistance. And I found this particularly interesting because there's a group at group of doctors at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital that are already trialling one such device. And they're using a biomarker called procalcitonin, which actually rises in the blood of those with bacterial infections, but not in the blood of those with viral infections. So they can take an assay from someone's blood, and it takes about 90 minutes to get a result. And they can see if it's over a threshold, then yes, we treat with antibiotics. And if it's not, then they treat with other drugs because it's probably a viral infection. And that, to me, is the way forward, because they've already saved about half of their use of antibiotics for situations where they would have just generically given an antibiotic just in case this person has an infection. And the problem is, though, is that that test is very expensive. The equipment's very, very bulky, and it takes a long time. So 90 minutes is just not quick enough for something to be used routinely in GP surgeries. So that's why, to me, it seems that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. There is a possibility of finding something, but we obviously need to just pool resources and put together all the different technologies and all the different understandings of markers, blood markers, for example, to see what we could do to make that test quicker.
I'd like to ask all of you, do you think this antibiotic resistance challenge, the test, the diagnostic test, is really well suited to a prize, though? Because the prize is designed to bring in sort of a lot of lateral thinkers and people who wouldn't normally be able to do this kind of thing. But if you want a diagnostic test to look for bacterial infections, can't you just commission a university to go and do it, or a device company to go and do it? Is it the sort of test, that the challenge, that really requires that maverick inventor to come in?
I think so, because if it was that straightforward, I think it would have been done by now, if it was a case of just hurling enough money at it through university department. And I think that it is something which, as Emily's saying, like that is generating some progress in this area. It's not like there isn't progress that's being made. But obviously we need something that's just going to be able to cut down that time, is going to perhaps be a bit smaller. And that's where that kind of sort of sideways thinking comes in, because you're taking, you know, you can use the principles that university scientists have developed, as in the case that Emily was talking about. But then if you can just think of some cunning way of twisting that into a device that will cut down that time, and that requires that spark of genius, I think. So, yeah, I do think it is a good idea. Yeah. But, of course, with this sort of device, there is the one slight problem, which is that it's slowing down this arms race between us and the antibiotic resistance if this device is made. But that arms race is still happening, and without new antibiotics coming on, and without ways of tackling the actual resistance problem, that's still, a big problem.
Emily?
I mean, it may be that there are, I don't know if this comes into the remit of the prize, but it may be that whilst people are out there trying to find new ways of distinguishing bacterial and viral infections, that there might also be other ways of tackling bacteria. So, for example, it's known now that bacteria communicate with each other through something called quorum sensing. And there are signalling pathways involved where the bacteria communicate that they're in a particular environment, and then they can all respond in a certain way. So if there was a way of tackling those signalling molecules, a totally different approach to looking at bacteria, and actually targeting the bacteria in that way rather than using a traditional antibiotic, then there might be a whole range of new ways of killing bacteria that we haven't seen yet. I don't know if that would be in the remit of the prize, but surely if we raise awareness and people are looking for any way of halting this use of antibiotics, then that could be something that can come as a result.
Just to make devil's advocate here, is this a case of like getting hooked on a sort of high-tech silver bullet solution where actually there's a lot of much cheaper or freer alternatives in terms of just culture change, in terms of how we prescribe antibiotics? And, you know, here's a device that, as you say, is very interesting in terms of like selecting whether we need to use them or not in the first place, but is also very expensive. I mean, for a fraction of that cost, couldn't we have a sort of effort to take beyond newspaper stories this sort of message that people should go to their doctor less often for antibiotics?
I think the point is that this campaign will raise that point. I think that the statistic is something like 50 million courses of antibiotics are prescribed in hospitals and GP surgeries just in the UK each year. And up to about half of those are thought to be unnecessary. And if people are aware that that's the case, then there might be less of a sort of knee-jerk reaction to say, right, my child or myself is ill and we have to have antibiotics. And the fact is GPs, under that pressure, they can't make decisions based on not enough information. So the knee-jerk response is, okay, let's play on the side of caution, and the same in hospitals, and in the same for livestock, where they use antibiotics as well. So yes, there's both sides. Yes, we need a way of distinguishing whether it's the right type of infection to give an antibiotic. We also need awareness for people not to ask for them unless they're really needing them, and to make sure they complete their courses, which is quite well known now, but still a lot of people don't do. And of course, not completing a course of antibiotics is the best way to let the bugs win, because that's how they're more likely to survive with superhigh resistance.
Let's move on to some of the other challenges that are up for the vote. Green flight, zero carbon flight, Adam, what do you make of that one?
So I think this one's spot on in terms of the subject matter, in terms of the scale of it. I mean, carbon emissions from flight now are, about 2.5% of global emissions, so you seem relatively small, but the crucial thing about flight is they're one of the fastest growing sources. In the UK, we'll go from 6% of all our emissions to about a quarter of all our emissions by the middle of the century. And more importantly, it's one of those things that's actually very hard to decarbonise, compared to the electricity sector. The beef I have with this is that the actual challenge they've set is about creating as close as possible zero carbon flight for going from Edinburgh to London, i.e. a domestic flight, which really, is that really, I mean, setting aside the sort of technology issues, culturally, is that really going to be the best approach? Shouldn't that journey be a high-speed rail journey, not a plane?
But isn't that just the starting point to say, can we find the technology to do it? And then it could be extended. I think, is that not just within the remit of the time scale to say, can we start this way?
I think I see your point. You've got to start somewhere. But I think at the same time, I think by doing it like that, especially with flight, where the size of the aeroplane is crucial, and the long haul flights are surely the things we should be addressing. I mean, that's there are no alternatives for holidaying or for short term holiday or business flights for long haul. They just don't exist at the moment, right? But there are alternatives to domestic flights. So why would you tilt the competition that way?
Well, it's presumably just because you've only got five years, I think, in which to come up with the answer to this. And, if the technology works for a short flight, then it probably could be then extended and expanded to a long-haul flight. But, it's just not feasible probably to...
I think the other thing is as well, is actually looking at the problem the wrong way? I think, is the solution to making a flight less damaging, is it actually alternatives to flying for something like London to Edinburgh? Isn't not like working with Google to take video conferencing onto a whole new level? I mean, there is clearly the interesting thing about where the growth in flights is coming from is it's almost entirely business, sort of recreational, apart from coming from Southeast Asia. Recreational flights are sort of plateauing, but the problem is business flights, so isn't it looking at alternative, those people don't always need to travel, it's...
This is my problem with having flight on this list, is that although obviously there are situations where flight is absolutely critical and necessary, trade and businesses to a degree is one of those, is that, a lot of business conferencing and business meetings and stuff now with the technology we have, you don't necessarily need to be there in person. Is it a bit of a luxury to have flight on this list?
I agree entirely. It is a luxury, but you can't ignore the reality that this growth is happening. And that, I was looking around just to see some of, just to get a sense of the scale of it. In China, in their 5-year plan up to next year, 2015, they had, 70 new airports blocked in for that. That's alone, and that's just the beginning, right? I totally agree with you. It does seem like a luxury, but you can't ignore the reality that growth is coming down the track.
But if that's going to happen anyway, I mean, yes, we could put resources into stopping that happening, that growth of industry, that growth of the flight as part of that industry. But if that is going to happen, then I think it is a good challenge to try and find ways to make flight less carbon rich in terms of its emissions, because they do have hydrogen fuel flights that have been, that there'd been a lot of research done by scientists about how to power planes using hydrogen, and that's totally carbon free, except for the fact that you need fossil fuels to make the hydrogen, to purify the hydrogen, to use as a fuel. And then you have to liquefy it, which is, again, very costly energetically and in terms of money. So if there was a way to make that process more efficient and easier, then there actually could be a way to use that in the hydrogen as the fuel.
It's interesting because it reminds me of the debate a bit around coal and carbon capture and storage. You know, the argument there is that it's going to happen anyway, so let's try and make it a bit better. You know, so in that respect, I think it has some merit. I'm also highly sceptical of, like, what technological breakthroughs. I don't see anything on the, you know, you talk about hydrogen, which has its own issues around, you know, there's a solar, you know, they're trying to do a solar around the world plane next year, but that's like for two people, right? So not really going to begin to start to address this problem. You know, there's been commercial flight airlines have been mucking around with mixes of biofuel, but then that gets into a whole other territory of problems, depending on what generation of biofuels you're talking about. So I don't know. I'm slightly sceptical as well. I mean, I'm an optimist and a technophile, but I'm slightly sceptical of what solutions are coming down the track that could be sped up by this.
I was going to ask you all, I mean, doesn't this challenge all come down to making jet fuel in a green way? Because you talked about Solar Impulse, the plane that's going to fly around the world with just on solar power. And this is obviously has an enormous wingspan, so you can fit on the solar panels. It's incredibly light. And I was checking out the engine requirements of that and comparing it to a Boeing 777, as you do. And it has four 10-horsepower engines. And if you look at one Boeing 777 engine, it produces 110,000 horsepower. To me, as if, okay, you're not going to find another energy sort of, you're not going to have an electric plane doing very impressive stuff. It's going to be just how can you get a greener jet fuel.
Look at electric cars, right? I mean, they're already struggling to get anything like the range and that. You scale it up to airplane. I mean, again, with the Solar Impulse, for example, you know, when they fly at night, they massively reduce the speed. So again, you know, we're decades away.
We're decades away from
solar and electric and stuff like that being some sort of viable. I mean, what the near term is going to be, a bit like it is with cars, more efficient engines and better fuel mixes, so there'll be blends of sort of biodiesel from, you know, biofuels from crops, from algae-based, from cooking oil, that sort of stuff. I think that's what we're going to see in the near term. And also some interesting stuff going on around air traffic control and rerouting stuff to make it more efficient. I think that's what we're going to see.
Nicola, you wanted to talk about the challenge of water, providing clean and safe water for everybody.
Well, I really think this is extremely important. It just seems like such a basic human right to have access to clean and safe water for drinking, for washing, for general consumption. And I feel that it's something which, in a way, compared to flight, is just so fundamental that this should be top of the political agenda all over the place. And I think it would be fitting for it to be the challenge, to win this as being the challenge. Because 97% of the earth, of the water on the earth, is salt water. Now, the trouble is that getting rid of the salt, the desalination process, is extremely energy intensive. It's very costly, which means that actually providing water that people can drink and use is extremely difficult to process. And I think that's the basis of this prize. It's coming up with a way to desalinate water. And considering that we use about 3,400 litres of water a day, I mean, we use an awful lot of water. And that's not just drinking and washing, but it's also the water that's used to fuel our lifestyles, to make the things that we use. And we're so reliant on water. And the thing is, there's a finite amount of fresh water out there. A lot of it's trapped in ice and in top of mountains and in glaciers and all that sort of thing. And that's being depleted. So we don't have fresh water resources to keep up with our consumption basically.
Why is salt water so hard to desalinate? Well, it's I know it's energy intensive, but what is so difficult about doing that and that makes it such a hard and expensive thing?
I think isn't it to do with relying on osmosis going backwards?
Yeah,
because it's reverse osmosis, and naturally water will want to move from where it is more watery, pure water, for example, into where it's less watery, so salt water. So naturally, the water would move into the salt water solution, down what's called a concentration gradient, into the sea, salty water. So what the scientists are trying to do is actually pull the water the other way, take it from something that's already not very much water relative to salt to something where there is more water. And that's not a natural process. That's going against chemistry. It's going against energetics, and it therefore requires a lot of energy.
And it's not, you know, obviously the thing is with salt is that it's dissolved in the water. Mm. You can't just filter it. You've got to remove it in some way. And that's, it takes a huge amount of financial and energetic input to do that. And of course, a lot of places where this is really becoming critical is in areas of the world where there aren't those resources to plow into this kind of research. So I think that it's really important that we do tackle that. And also you've got to remember that about 2 million people die from badly contaminated water as it is. That shouldn't be happening. We shouldn't be having that in this day and age. And so for me, providing people with clean water is just critical.
I think it's an interesting one because it affects both you tend to think of it as a developing world issue, but it's not just it's the developed world as well. You know, we're ending up with like continents like Australia, which are, you know, fast on track to be entirely dependent on desal for their water needs. And also there is a real cost issue. You know, in the UK here, you know, the one we've got east of London hardly ever gets fired up even in times of drought because it's just really expensive, even by UK standards. So, you know, there is... Clearly, this is a global issue. You know,
there's also the question. Well, the problem of the fact that our population is growing. We all know that we're going to hit 9-10 billion people. We have to feed our population, and that requires growing more crops, and that means irrigating the crops, and that requires fresh water too. So many areas of our life. It's not just about having a glass of water and being able to drink that. It's about how that is so fundamental to growing our food, to keeping sanitary levels high, that side of things, which impacts all of us. This is literally a global problem.
It just seems a slightly arbitrary sort of division to have this and the food separate. I thought actually it's separate because you really could. It seems slightly impossible to address one without the other, I have to say.
Well, I think that the food one sort of came down to the fact that, I mean, that case sort of seemed to be related to the idea that people want to eat more meat, and obviously farming animals is extremely energy intensive, more so than growing crops. Emily?
But I guess as we're going to talk about with the malnutrition and the food issue is that, yes, they come down to the same thing, but the technologies or the advances that we might need in order to create that are going to be very different. So for the water issue, we need desalination. Mm-hmm. And as I guess we'll discuss in a minute, for the food issues, it's going to be a whole different source of challenge to address that.
They do overlap. And Adam, you were going to talk about the sustainable food challenge and what sort of technologies might people be looking at there, these inventors that come in to go for this £10 million prize?
So, I mean, obviously, one of the things that gets touted a lot is GM, genetic modification. So that's something that... is talked about as a way to increase yields, to, you know, in terms of resistance to pests and as temperatures get more extreme. So that's one thing that's being looked at on technology. But I mean, there's also kind of culture change stuff here, which, you know, is I think maybe we'll get into, you know, the big issue here is increasing meat and dairy consumption around the world. You know, the now, sorry to bring everything back to emissions, but, you know, food and dairy, meat and dairy alone are nearly 15% of our global emissions, according to the UN, which is more than all transport combined. So all those planes, all those cars, etc., are, you know, and I think that the interesting thing about this is for me is what about the question of like whether we eat too much meat or not. Is it's interconnected with a whole load of other areas as well, like local pollution in terms of nitrogen runoff from farmland into waterways to health issues as well. You know, I mean, there was a really interesting paper which I looked at recently about a European team that looked about nitrogen pollution from farming and particularly looked at what would happen if you massively reduced dairy and meat and that consumption. And they basically said if everyone became a demetarian, this idea that you eat half as much meat and dairy as you do now, then Europeans would cut their saturated fat intake by 40% as well. So, you know, there's a massive, so all the attendant health and heart benefits that would have.
I wonder if there's a danger of people going in for this challenge taking a very sort of high-tech Western view of things and maybe having that sort of and not being down enough on the ground in a way. I mean, my understanding was that some of the problems with food in various parts of Africa and where have you, is keeping the stuff fresh from field to market and making sure that you can, you get the most out of your, you don't get losses on the way. And so can you keep this stuff clean and cool? Yeah. And as you take it until you get it into people's mouths, because if you're just getting crazy losses along the way, then, you know, you're already vulnerable. Crops and harvests are, you know, in trouble.
So I think there are like parallels here with the flight one, that maybe we're looking at technology solutions, but actually we're talking about cultural issues. I mean, there was a really interesting report from the Institute of Mechanical Engineers on food waste, which is not something you'd normally expect them to be getting into. And they basically found that in the developed world, most of the food waste comes at the sort of consumer end. So it's you and I leaving some bag salad or whatever on our fridge past its date. In the developing world, it's exactly the problem you've touched on. It's stuff getting, you know, stuff not getting to market quick enough. It's stuff rotting in warehouses and so on, and inadequate refrigeration facilities. That sort of basic, what we take for granted in the developed world infrastructure for processing and handling and storing food. And that's where a lot of the waste happens in the developing world.
But that's assuming that we actually have enough food, full stop, to feed people, and then it's, yes, I absolutely agree. It's really important to keep that fresh. But I think one of the main issues with this particular challenge is that, A, the food that we have at the moment, there's something like 800 million people across the globe who are undernourished, and even more who are not receiving enough of vital nutrients. So, for example, 1 to 2 billion people are iron deficient. And 120 million don't have enough vitamin A, which can lead to blindness. So I think there's two issues. There's one is, how do we get more nutrients from the food that we have available, or what other foods can we use to provide those nutrients, be it genetic modification, as you spoke about, or there's also a big thing about using insects, which are 50% protein, and they can supply much higher levels of minerals such as zinc and iron than meat can. And the main issue with that is just getting people to actually get their head around the idea of eating insects.
Yeah.
But then there's also just a pure quantity thing. We spoke about the population going up to 9 billion in the next sort of 20 years or 25, 30 years. And we're going to need to double our food production just to keep those people alive. And the fact is that we don't have enough of the people we have right now. And even if we've got the right quantity, we haven't got the right nutrients.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the undernourishment statistics, the things that really, as you say, it's around 850 million people-ish. And what's striking about the graph on that is that it came down a lot in the last two decades, and it's now it seems to be hovering around that point, which is slightly depressing and suggests that something is needed to move the dial, as it were. I think what you're talking about really is the two big picture things here, which is population growth, and then I'm going to say this because I'm coming from an environmental perspective, but climate change. You know, the IPCC report earlier this year talked of food yields declining globally by around 2% per decade, which, when you look at population growth going the other way, is kind of terrifying math. I mean, you know, there's let's not make any bones about it. Some parts of the world will actually see an increase in food yields, and particularly in Northern Europe and America, because of the extra CO2 in the air. But a lot of parts of the world are going to really suffer with their staples.
What do we think about this dementia challenge? How can we help people with dementia to live independently for longer?
I thought this was quite interesting because it didn't seem to be about sort of finding a cure for dementia as such. It's more about making it easier to live with, which I thought was quite interesting, because the others seem very, very broad and sort of like we've just been discussing, like, well, which question are we trying to answer with this prize? And this seems to have definitely been narrowed down a little bit more. And so in a way, I mean, there are already apps and interesting technologies that you can use to help to remind you to do certain things, to help you, you know, these sort of life logging things to help you to take pictures throughout the day, and all sorts of technologies that people are developing to try to solve some of these questions already. So I feel like this one is sort of, it's people are already inspired by this idea. I do think that.
I think I'd actually vote for this one because, and I'm undecided, but I think this one, looking at how chronically underfunded dementia research is, and I know Cameron has announced a new sort of war on dementia, but we'll see how that goes. I mean, you're looking at, you know, a child born today having higher than a 1 in 4 chance of reaching their 100th birthday. You've got a doubling of dementia cases probably in the UK by 2050. And it's you see it happening, and everyone will know, you know, people or have friends who have grandparents who are sort of in this situation. And it's a really staggering thing. And I don't know what sort of technologies they would come up with. And my concern about over this one is that you end up again with a sort of a technological fix that isn't actually particularly practical? I mean, how useful are apps when you are, when your mind is going really badly wrong? I mean, I'm sure it can be used to keep track of certain drugs, but only up to a point.
Well, what was interesting was last year I was at the Cheltenham Science Festival, and there they were talking also about the idea of taking iPads and stuff into care homes. And this isn't just for people with dementia, but the idea that it actually really stimulates and engages people. And so, you know, that might be one area where it can sort of, that sort of idea of interactive technology could be quite important as well.
Mm. Emily?
There is an interesting piece on the Horizon documentary about the prize, where there was a group in Birmingham who made this robot called, they call it Bob the Robot Carer, which is very much in its infancy because it can't go upstairs or anything like that. But it's designed to help those with dementia to remember things like you spoke about with the apps, but an actual physical non-human being that can do that to monitor when people get up, whether they've taken their medications, where they've left their keys, if they've put too much water in the kettle, if they haven't turned the kettle off. And the idea is to extend the technology to understand how these robots could potentially help and assist human carers, because I think part of the issue here is it's something like 50,000 people are expected to leave work next year to care for those with dementia. Mm. So it's helping those people to not have so much responsibility and so much pressure to look after their relatives, their friends, their family. And if technology can help them to do that and have some peace of mind. There was also, they're trialling this new kitchen where there's sensors everywhere that says, this is how much water you've put in the kettle. This is how long you've turned the oven on for. This is how much milk you need to put in your cup of tea so it doesn't spill everywhere. And yes, this is huge technological kind of futuristic stuff, but if the money was put into this and that became widely available, or even in such a way that small parts of it were widely available, then I think that would really impact the integrity of the lives of people with dementia, but also the people who are having to take time out or just quit their jobs in order to support those people and look after them.
Nicola, it sounds like your Internet of Things you were talking about on the podcast a few weeks back, this idea of everything around the home being wired up, and, you know, I saw that as a fairly dystopian scenario, but there is a case where you could have that kind of wired up home and your home keeping tabs on how you're doing, maybe.
I think this idea of a smart home, it does sound, to some people it can sound quite threatening, but as Emily pointed out, that there are ways in which this could really be harnessed to help people, that it can keep tabs on stuff that it becomes harder and harder to keep tabs on yourself. And I think that is really extremely important. But also, I do think that, as I said, this is looking at one aspect of dementia. It's looking at how to cope with dementia. And that's extremely important, as Emily said, not just for people suffering from dementia, but from those who are also indirectly living with the effects of it. But I do think it's really important that outside of this prize, we continue to pour more and more funding into looking at how dementia happens, what's happening in the brain, what are those mechanisms, and really that kind of fundamental research into understanding the condition itself.
This is arguably one of the, if not the most emotive subjects on the list. And I wouldn't argue with any of you on the importance of it. I think my only feeling is whether this is the place where, if you care about it, where you would cast your vote. I think actually arguably the most important place would be at the general election next year. I think, you know, this is really a question of political priorities and how much resource, you know, will be, you know, the reality is a lot of this stuff will be delivered by the NHS. So I think this really actually comes into the political arena, and a lot of the technologies we've talked about, which are really interesting and are coming down the track, it's going to be a question of cost for deploy, you know, it's going to be the usual cost benefit stuff, and it's going to be a question of how much those can be really rolled out. And I don't think that's going to be a question of how much money the NHS has and how high dementia is on the priority of it.
And as Nicola said, talking about how can we actually potentially find a cure or a way of reversing the disease, I know that there are groups like in Manchester with new PET scanning techniques where they're actually finding ways to look at the brain and look at early markers and early signals that Alzheimer's might develop. And that's a relatively new thing. And it's about perhaps supporting and putting money towards the drug companies who can then use that to try and develop new drugs. Because up till now, there hasn't been any incentive to find new drugs because there's been no early enough markers, because once the brain has changed, then it's sort of irreversible and nothing can stop that. But if these new scans are able to show that the brain is on its way to changing, but it hasn't happened to such an extent that it can now be reversed, then I think you're right. It would be great to see money and support being put into, as well as supporting those with it, finding a way, finding drugs to stop it happening in the first place.
At the end of the day, we're all going to be, hopefully we're all going to be living longer, but let's make sure that quality of life is there.
So the one challenge we haven't talked about yet is paralysis, how we can restore movement to people with paralysis, given the kind of freedom of movement that the rest of us have. And what do we make of this one? Does this look like a good place for a prize?
I think this is a really important issue as well. 50,000 people in the UK are paralysed, and that's a much higher figure than I had any concept of. Every 8 hours, someone in the UK becomes paralysed. Now, that's enormous. And I guess a lot of us don't have experience of it, but I would imagine for those who do, it's just huge, and it's a larger issue than I had realised. And for those people to be able to find a way to allow them to stand, to walk, to use their arms, for those who are fully paralysed, to use any part of their limbs would be totally amazing. And I know that we spoke about with some of the others that there are some advances already being made, and this is an area where I think, yes, we are seeing things happening. It's not this pie in the sky kind of big open space of like, well, what can we do? There's a group at UCL, I think it is, that are making robots that can be controlled by your thinking, so you don't actually have to even be able to move a finger to be able to have these remote controlled robotics that can go and move around for you, open your doors, whatever it is you might need to do. And the robotic exoskeletons, which I know are also being trialled, which you can use, you can navigate using a joystick. But again, if there was a way of tuning into the brain waves, which to me seems totally futuristic, but they are doing it. And I saw a demonstration of they had a kind of a thing on this guy's head, and it tuned into his brain waves, and there were tiny like microvoltage changes in his brain waves that actually allowed this robot to move. So with potentially just advances in understanding of neuroscience, so brain science, and also technological advances in robotics, if we can couple those two together, then that's going to cause a huge improvement in lifestyle and understanding for those who've got, you know, it was awful situation.
I think my concern about this one was that it seemed to be the one which really called for high-tech knowledge. Like, if you want to plug straight into someone's brain, if you want to be controlling robotic limbs or trying to bypass electronically where they have a severed spine or something and then carry on the nerves. A lot of this is high-end stuff, right, that you can't do out your garden shed, and it's not going to be some clockmaker called John Harrison who comes along and solves that one. But what do you reckon, Nicola?
Well, I think this is an area which is kind of taking off a little bit. I mean, not obviously as rapidly as we'd like, and, you know, not with nearly as much money as I'm sure we'd all like. But, for example, I think it's in 2016, there's a cybathlon that's going to be held in Switzerland, and that's very much encouraging people to look at how we can bring that sort of sense of mobility and actual mobility to people who have some form of paralysis. So I think it's becoming something that people are looking at as an interesting, with this idea, like Emily said, of using your brainwave to be able to move stuff. But actually, in terms of this idea of whether it's going to require sort of completely sort of specialist knowledge, I agree, obviously, on the medical side of things. But what I think would be interesting would be, you know, you look at those exoskeletons now. I mean, they're big and they're bulky and they're, you know, they're difficult things, you know, physically to kind of negotiate. So there might be a way that someone could come up with some way of sort of slimming things down, making it less obvious, less of a kind of cage-looking thing, and making it to try to break down that sort of idea of, you know, if you look at really old-fashioned wheelchairs, my goodness, they look like, you know, huge, clunky, bulky things. Now they're quite sleek. And even that sort of idea of sort of refining a model would be really worthwhile,
I think.
A lot
of that would come from actually batteries or energy sources, because, you know, the big things with some of these exoskeletons is how long can you run it for? How big is the battery pack? It's normally in a rucksack on your back. And how far can you go? I mean, you know, some of these things, it'll power you enough to get halfway to the shops if the shop is really close to your flat.
Exactly. So I think it's not just necessarily a case of coming up with an entirely new and different concept. It might be about refining the concepts that are out there to actually make it workable for real people in real homes. And the other thing I would say about this is it's not just about sort of physical movement and things. It's also about the psychological impact, I think, too, and about giving people some feeling that they actually, you know, can do things and can do things for themselves that they might not otherwise have been able to do. And I think that the absolute joy that that would bring is also makes this an extremely worthwhile prize.
The public vote closes on June the 25th at 7:10 p.m. That's British summertime, of course. You can vote by going to the BBC Horizon site or by text SMS. Text your chosen keyword to 60011. To vote for antibiotic resistance, text antibiotics. For sustainable nutrition, text food. For dementia care, text dementia. For restoring mobility, text paralysis. For fresh water, text water. And for zero carbon flight, text flight. Right, before we go, you lot around the table, what would you vote for? Anyone decided yet?
I think I have to say water, because I really think that that is an absolute fundamental necessity for every single person on this planet.
Okay, Nicholas on water. Adam?
I'm voting for food because it's a basic need. It affects everyone, and because of the twin threats of climate change and population, with water a close second.
What do you reckon, Emily?
I'm with Adam on food, but I'm also championing antibiotic resistance, because that's just, if we don't do anything about it soon, that's really going to affect all of our lives.
Okay, and I'm going to throw my hat in for dementia, I think. We'll see how that goes. A huge thanks to my panel, Emily, Nicola and Adam. That's all for this week. We'll be back in 10 days' time with another edition. But from me, Ian Sample, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, good voting. Goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.